When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, listeners, echoers, double voicers, and memory keepers. This week's theme is actually the title of the book of the author we're interviewing. Lissa Soep has written a book called Other People's Words. And I am Brooke Warner. I am here with Grant Faulkner, my co-host. Grant, this is a really special book. It's unusual for us and this show to be interviewing the author Lissa pre-publication, but it's okay because we want to encourage you all to rush out and pre-order this beautiful book and then thank us for it later. Grant, Other People's Words, you know, the whole premise of the book is that other people's words live on in our own vocabulary and how we think about things, and never is this more present to us probably than after we lose people. It's a philosophical and literary book, so it's not completely easy to nail down in a simple way. But what I got out of it is this idea of how people live on, how they echo, how we double voice. And Lissa centers her work on the Russian scholar Mikhail Bakhtin and his ideas around language. And in the early pages of the book, she writes, "For Bakhtin, a conversation of the most intense kind is a monologue that is really a dialogue. One person is talking, but their words engage with something vital outside themselves, beyond their limits. The imagined voice of a silent speaker who enters the dialogue as a hidden, hovering participant, sometimes as a haunting." It's quite powerful, you know, to be thinking about how that works in the mind and in our experience. And I wondered how much that resonated with you and how much you're a person who has a rich inner monologue in your mind that are really dialogues.
Yeah, you know, I actually read Bakhtin when I was getting my MFA, and I've forgotten a lot of what I read, but I was entranced by him when I first read him, and I loved his thoughts. And the one thing I remember was that he had this notion of polyphony, or simultaneity of a novel being, having multiple voices that overlap and mix. And he in particular wrote about Dostoevsky in this way, which I then applied to William Faulkner's work and made it really more meaningful as a result. And when you just said that, the monologue that is a dialogue, because yeah, my mind definitely works that way. And the novel that I just finished is essentially that, you know, it's about a forbidden love affair, and one person writes letters to the other, but the letters are never sent. So the novel is a type of monologue that's also a dialogue. It's a confession and a type of diary, but with an intended reader, or a pretend reader, I guess. And I feel like basically this is, yeah, how my mind works as well. I'm always kind of in conversation with somebody else, even if the monologue is in my brain.
Yeah, I totally relate to that. And I imagine a lot of people do. My inner dialogues often take the form of what I imagine someone would say to me and how I would respond. Mm-hmm. Like, I'll have these rich conversations in my head about interactions with people on the street, what I would do in some hypothetical situation that, of course, never comes to pass. And that's the work of imagination, of course. I mean, we see kids, you know, who are constantly monologuing with themselves out loud. And in fact, they're dialoguing. And I also think it's why it's so valuable to unplug, because I know I'm less likely to have those kind of intense internal monologue dialogues if I have my AirPods tuned into my music or my podcasts, though sometimes I can. You know, that's interesting. Like, I can sometimes listen to something and at the same time be imagining in that way. But the difference is that a lot of times that daydreaming, you know, just stems from being in silence or just not paying attention to something, and especially out in the world, right? So I'm thinking, in Lisa's estimation, there's not a better or worse way to engage with words, which is what I really appreciated. The book has like zero judgment to it. You know, it's just sort of laying out to you, this is other people's words. And like, the technology plays a role a little bit insofar as like there's email and there's texting and there's stuff going on. But all that really matters is seeing how we engage with words and thinking about it.
Yeah. And just to give listeners a little bit more of some context for the book, it's framed around Lissa's friends and the fact that she lost two of her closest friends is in somewhat close succession. And the jacket copy asks, "What if the great love of your life is friendship? But the book is really, you know, so much more about how she holds these friends close in the aftermath of the death in this very unexpected way, like through their words, which you say. And in the case of her friend Christine, there's this whole body of work that she's left behind. This resonates with me because I'm going to leave a lot of words behind. And she was a writer, and Lissa has, you know, letters and poems and texts that she reproduces in the book. And also, you know, this friend suffered from a mysterious disease, and her voice and her words changed over time as a result. And Lissa identifies that towards the end of her life, that Christine really did have two versions of herself. And she writes, "Christine intermingled two versions of herself, separated by time, abandonment, and atrophy. Remnants of her past voice survived. They contained everything she had ever loved. Even with all the dreadful forgetting, that voice remembered and still, now and then, had the capacity to sound."
Yeah, that's such a powerful concept. I was really taken with so much of what she wrote because it made me think of two things I've experienced in my own life. You know, one is an experience similar to Lissa's, where a friend of mine started to go through some pretty serious mental illness. And so the person she was and the person she became were similar and different. And I remember listening for my old friend in her new language, you know, and like when she was spiraling with illness, how much I was like, she's her, but she's not her at the same time. And that was like what Lissa describes in this book as a double voicing. My friend's name was Katie, and you know, she was the old Katie and the new Katie at once sometimes, and it was a very strange experience, but also one that shows us the continuum of a life as it goes through changes, even if they're changes that we don't invite or sometimes wouldn't want. And I could imagine a scenario like this with someone who goes through a gender transition, you know, someone who changes very profoundly, but the essence of the person is the same. And then I was thinking about this experience too with old letters. Like, I have a lot of old letters from high school, particularly the year I did abroad in 1993, thank goodness, on the eve of email, because I have all of these handwritten letters from my friends and from family. I have ones that I wrote that friends saved for me and gave back to me. And, you know, I've gone back and read them, and I am not the me that I was then, right? I mean, the words are mine from back then, but they feel foreign to me, completely foreign when I read them. And they bring me back to a time, and sometimes I can't believe how I articulate myself, right? And this is kind of the whole premise of Lissa's book, how each of us is so vast, and that the lifetime of thoughts and words that we have is really an epic internal conversation with the self. And that within that, it's also like we're not original. You know, that's another thing that's really fascinating. It's like things have been shoveled into us by others. And that's just a reality. And how to think about that is kind of a big premise, but it got me thinking about how each of us is like a universe. You know, we're expansive, we're ever changing. And so if you start to feel annoyed or put out by other people, I think this is a good book to turn to, you know, because it really does get you to tap into the beauty of a single human soul.
It's interesting you mentioned letters, Brooke, because beyond my novel, I have a similar history with letters as you do. And I'm so happy I grew up pre-internet, because I was an avid letter writer, and I've actually saved every letter I've ever received. And I hope to someday read through them all and essentially revisit my younger friends and all the surprises they will definitely have for me. And, you know, I recently experienced a couple of friends were cleaning out basements of their parents' homes a while back, and they told me they'd found my letters. And each time, yeah, whatever. They said they were good letters. They enjoyed reading them, all that. But I was actually, when they asked me if I wanted them, I was actually a little skittish, because for some reason I didn't want to really meet my younger self. And I guess I was afraid I'd be embarrassed by him. And it's the same with my journals, because I've actually never cracked any of them open, even though I've kept a journal since I was 7. So I have a whole stack of them. And I envision a time where I'm going to sit down with the letters and the journals and read them, but I'm also not sure when that someday will be. You know, I keep putting it off. And I was recently talking with an older writer who I really admire, and she's nearing the end of her life, and we were joking about how our kids have actually never read our work as far as we know. And she told me that she'd asked one of her daughters to actually burn her journals. And her daughter kind of glibly said, "Oh, sure, definitely." You know, like it was just this task on the list. Mm-hmm. And the cruel joke was on us, because we've obviously each kind of protected our writing and saved it. And now, you know, maybe it doesn't have the value that we thought it would, you know, or intended, you know, because these words do have, you know, I mean, who knows what value they have, really? We don't know. Even the daughter who said she would burn them, I kind of joke that maybe she won't, you know. So anyway, it's just kind of interesting because we're also not in control of our words and how they're received and what story is made of those words. So yeah, I've been thinking about this as well because, you know, after my dad died, I always said how precious it would be if he'd just written 10,000 words about his life or 5,000 or really anything. And I don't know how that would change or add to the way I think about him, but I guess I think we can never get enough of a loved one's essence or story. So I hope my friend's daughter doesn't burn her journals because even if they contain nothing but, you know, petty worries, as we were joking about, petty worries also can tell us a lot about a life. So what about you, Brooke? Have you experienced something similar with your dad dying?
Yeah, you know, my dad also didn't have much writing that he left behind. I mean, sermons, because he was a pastor, so there's that. And I have had the experience of having him feel very present and very close. It's been less than a year. And so I hear his voice still in my head. Like he called me honey. And I just sometimes hear that honey, just that single word echo in my mind. And there have been many times where I can hear exactly what Lissa says. Like I hear someone else say something and it sends me into a remembrance of him. So that's interesting. And, you know, we just don't live in a culture that does a very good job of remembering, you know, of honoring. So I thought that this book really offered deep permission to hear my dad's words and just be grateful for how they echo. And, you know, I don't think I'm going to hear his voice so present forever. So for now I'm listening, and I think the book kind of helped me think about tuning into it more.
You're right. And I think we have just such a strange cultural imperative to move on from really anything, but especially death, and, you know, just let time heal and be done with it. You know, I feel like grieving sometimes is almost like a check mark on a list. You cross it off. And what I've learned about grieving, though, is like quite the opposite. You know, it never stops. It just takes different forms. So it's not a straight line. It's more of a spiral. And one of my heroes of philosophy, like Lissa's hero, Bakhtin, is Roland Barthes. And he was very close to his mother. And when his mother died, he kept note cards nearby. And each time he had a memory of her, he wrote it down on a note card. And he didn't intend to do anything with these. But after he died, they were compiled into a book. I think it was called The Morning Diaries or The Morning Diary. And, you know, just one of the lovely things about the book is how it does show how grieving is this kind of interesting, constant conversation. You know, it's sometimes silence, but there are all these kind of interruptions in your daily life with a memory or the presence of another, of the person you're grieving for. But just to go to another topic before we end, it was really hard to read this book without thinking about AI. And we're going to ask Lissa about this in the interview, but the whole book is a celebration of this idea of the collective and a kind of treatise on the idea that our words aren't really our own. And it did make me think about AI and kind of feel like maybe a lot of us are overly invested in the uniqueness of our own words. And I wondered what your thoughts were on this as you read the book.
Yeah, I definitely picked up on that as well. This idea that, like, actually your words are not as unique as you might think. And it just got me thinking, and Lissa's going to speak to this in the interview as well, you know, how she hears the echo of her mom when she wakes up her children. I have that same exact experience, and I'm sure many people do. You know, I sometimes think things that my mom would say. You know, like when I was a kid, we used to pull up to the house and she would always say, here we are at our house. It was just the thing that she said every time, though. And so almost every time I pull into our driveway, I think it, but I don't say it out loud. And it's really interesting. So it's a way that I hold her with me. And then, you know, I hear my own words in James's voice. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm like, oh my gosh, he says that because I say that, you know. So it's just, it's true that we are not as unique as we think we are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the jury is still out on AI, because part of me does totally feel like it's plagiarism in this weird way. But how is it any different from a child mimicking its parent and then learning its own way of communicating as it grows up? You know, those are things I think about. And then, you know, like I said, like we unconsciously lift other people's words, which makes us the same as AI in that way. You know, we're just like a big morass of words. But, you know, Lissa clearly is more focused on the meaning that other people's words carry for us and how they stay with us because they're connected to the people that we know and love and have associated associations to. So that's really the point of this book, but it is a book that will make you think. So get it, read it. It's awesome. Very excited to talk to Lissa. We'll get that privilege after this very short interlude. Welcome back, everyone. We're so pleased to have Lissa Soap with us today. She's a senior editor for audio at Vox Media and special projects producer and senior scholar in residence at YR Media. She has a PhD from Stanford, where she studied education, social theory, and linguistic anthropology with leading Bakhtin scholars. She lives in San Francisco. Lissa, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, we're thrilled because this is such a powerful and also an unusual book in the best sense of the word. It spans philosophy, personal story, grief, and general musings about language and the power of words. So I was wondering if we could start by you telling us about its origins.
Sure. Well, I can say maybe a bit about, you know, what the book is about and then how I started writing it, if that makes sense.
That would be perfect.
Great. So Other People's Words is the story of two friends of mine who died around the same time about 10 years ago in very different ways. One of them, Christine, died slowly after a long and mysterious illness that did a lot of damage to her mind and her relationships before ultimately taking her life. And Johnny died in an instant. He was run over by a boat when he was swimming in a lake. And so Other People's Words is the story of these two friendships. And it's also a story of friendship itself as a great love in our lives that isn't always recognized as some of the other intimacies that define us in our relationships. And it's about what it felt like for me to love these friends and lose them and then find them again and again through language. So the sort of like shape-shifting power of language in the face of loss is a through line in the book. And I wrote it in part to try to understand how it is that we use language to hold our loved ones close after they're gone by carrying their voices within our own. And part of how I learned to experience language that way is through this philosopher, Mikhail Bakhtin, who had a really radical and expansive way of thinking about language encapsulated in this phrase of his, which became a phrase of mine and the title of the book. And Bakhtin would say, our speech is filled to overflowing with other people's words. Whether we notice it or not, our speech is made up of the language of others, whether it's intonations, phrases, or the sort of spirit of those who've come before us that makes its way into our own words. So that's essentially, you know, the shape of the book, the really centrally about these two friendships. And then Bakhtin is kind of like a presiding spirit who happens to have this really fascinating life story of his own. So that sort of comes in and out of the book as well.
That's so interesting, Lissa. And yeah, I wanted to go even deeper with your relationship to Bakhtin, because I've experienced him, you know, purely as a literary theorist. So it's interesting that you brought him into the intimacies of your life, I guess, especially with your friendships and your loss.
Yeah.
And so I was wondering if you could just kind of tell us more about that, about how he is a spirit presiding over the book.
Yeah. So I studied Bakhtin. I first read his work in a grad school class. I happen to be in the grad school class with one of the people I write about in the book. So as I said, there's these two friendships that are at the center of Other People's Words. And one is with another couple, Mercy and Christine. And Christine is the friend of mine who passed away. Her partner for 17 years is my friend Mercy. Thank God. And Mercy and I were in this grad school class together where we were first assigned this Russian literary critic and philosopher of language. I actually wasn't sure what to call him because he's kind of both in the book. We were assigned his ideas back in the 90s when we were in grad school. And that was a time in the US where Bakhtin, you sort of would be hard pressed to be in a whole range of different kinds of academic departments and not encounter Bakhtin. It was a little bit of a heyday for Bakhtin at that time. And so initially, I was really intrigued by his ideas in a more academic way, and I wrote about him in my dissertation. You know, I loved this notion that our speech is dialogic even when only we're speaking alone. So Bakhtin was interested in dialogue not as conversation between people, but dialogue as a property of our own speech. And I just, that kind of blew my mind, and it felt really inviting and expansive, and, but only in an intellectual sense, I think, until I experienced these losses and I found myself, you know, in some of my last visits with Christine, or when I was spending time with Emily, who is the surviving love of Johnny, I was thinking about Bakhtin and some of his ideas, and I found them really consoling, because I was noticing whether it was I was kind of threading my voice with Christine's, or I would be with Christine and her language. She didn't have much language left, but what was there, I would notice like lines of poetry that I knew she loved that had survived in a voice that had lost so much, and yet these threads of poetry remained. Or there were all of these ways that I was hearing the sort of the reverberations of their words and others as I experienced those losses and witnessed those who were experiencing them in acute ways, the loves of Christine and Johnny's lives. And so then I was like, maybe there's something to this. Maybe this philosophy has something to offer other people who are interested in language and how it operates in our lives to form connections, and how it can provide some kind of consolation when we aren't hearing anymore from people whose voices we cherish.
I love that, Lissa, because when I was in grad school, there was one of the classes that I took, the teacher talked about the shock of recognition. Mm-hmm. And I had that moment of the shock of recognition in reading your book, because I recently lost my dad. Mm. And so just thinking about it, but it was very comforting, actually. Aww. And so much to love. It, also, just the way that you weave Bakhtin in, and I do want to ask about that specifically, because we have a show in which a lot of writers listen.
Yeah.
And we've interviewed Pico Iyer, who wrote a book about Graham Greene, or wove Graham Greene into his memoir. Helen MacDonald wove T.H. White into her memoir, H is for Hawk. So there's kind of this legacy of doing what you've done. And your book is kind of a memoir, but not really. And so
Thank
I was
you.
Just curious. Yeah. I was very curious about how you are how you thought about your book, and whether this idea of like weaving in this other person, like you said, his philosophies, but also his life, you know, were you drawing from inspiration on that? And how did you think about it, you know, when you were coming to the page in terms of what you wanted the book to be?
Absolutely drawing from inspiration. Maggie Nelson, of course, you know, established early on, and was a, you know, because I've been working on this book for long enough, it wasn't that far out from the Argonauts that I started forming these ideas. And so the Argonauts was a really important anchor text that I kept revisiting. Also just the scale of her book, how like exquisitely small, and you know, it, and the way it operated in scale and intimacy, and then the way that these theory kind of like floated. In some cases, she did that interesting thing on the margins where she would just, rather than doing traditional citations, she would just like name scholars in the margins, of, you know, so learn from that. Another writer artist who I went to school on is actually Patti Smith. In Just Kids, you know, like the way she talks about the poet Rimbaud and sort of her like just sort of love for and sort of chasing his work and his story. I also like literally typed out passages of that book in order to get a feel for how it was in my fingers, in order to kind of think about how I could relate to Bakhtin in a very humanizing way, because I had to unlearn and shed a lot of bad habits that I had acquired through a PhD program where you learn conventions of citation and like just all of these ways that my initial instincts were wrong in how I brought Bakhtin in. And it took a really long time to like find that, I hope, a kind of lighter touch and more kind of relatable presence for him, so that he's almost alongside the other sort of present day characters in the book.
That's so interesting. Listen, I love how you were talking earlier about the way a song or a poem or a pattern of speech, you know, brings a person we've lost to the fore.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about how, you know, a person remember is confined to the memory of the people who remember them. Mm-hmm. But Bakhtin has a more expansive view than that, which you write about when explaining his ideas about great experiences versus small experience. So I was wondering if you could speak to this a bit and whether I'm reading this correctly, that in other people's words, we also connect to a collective whole.
That's right.
And there's a collective legacy for us to tap into.
That's right. And also time travel, right? Like other people's words are kind of portals to other times and places. And sometimes that really happens, right? Where you hear a lilt in your own voice and you sound exactly like your parent and you're suddenly transported back to what it felt like to be around a kitchen table. Or when, in my case, I think about like how my mom used to wake me up in the morning and then I would hear myself doing the same thing to my own children. So Bakhtin had this distinction between small experience and great experience. And in small experience, which was unfortunately how we spend a lot of our lives, in a way, the world around us is objectivized, is the word he used, you know, and there isn't necessarily always kind of an inner life, or there isn't sort of that multivocality in how we interact with people in the world. But in moments of great experience, there's a kind of transcendence. And he says, everything is alive, everything speaks, and it speaks in multiple registers. And he talks about like an open inner kernel and inner infinity, that there's a kind of like endlessness, or like unfinalizability is another word he would use, that language can sometimes unlock for us. And maybe it's just a glimpse of it and it goes away, you know, and it certainly doesn't overtake the grief and loss that language and nothing else has the power to undo. But I think your read on it is also my read on it, that it kind of opens a world of possibility for a feeling of connection, memory, possibility that can, yeah, as we said, provide comfort.
Well, Lissa, you don't write about AI in the book, but we have to ask about it, because several times I wondered, you know, what about AI and how AI is literally using other people's words to echo back to us a number of things we ask about it. And so I just wondered what you think about AI in the context of Bakhtin. And I just want to put this quote out. I mean, you said it, right? Our speech is filled to overflowing with other people's words. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you thought, if he were alive today, would he be an advocate for AI? And just, you know, your thoughts more generally.
Thank you. You're the first person to ask me that question, but I have like a note on my phone of like, I should write an essay about this.
Yes, you should.
Do not expect that I have essay ready thoughts on this topic, because it's a lot to kind of hold in your head at once. Like, what would Bakhtin have to say about generative AI and large language models and ChatGPT? But I do have like a running list of random thoughts. So, not quite ready for prime time, but I'm just really happy to know that you picked up that thread, because that alone just makes me feel like people will hopefully think about it as the book goes out, and people will have some powerful ideas that I'm eager to like absorb as hopefully some conversation happens. There is a tiny nod to it in the book, actually. It's not my own original reporting, but I reference an article that I read in the New York Times about Laurie Anderson and Lou Reed. So they were a couple, and Lou Reed died, and then Laurie Anderson became like an artist in residence at a university's computer science department. And this was pre-ChatGPT, but basically they created a model that was, you know, kind of trained on everything Laurie Anderson had ever said, everything Lou Reed had ever said. And then you could prompt the model to generate poetry in their blended voices. So I just thought, even before everybody in the world was sort of trying to grapple with what we should make of generative AI, that experiment, I love that it centers art and artists, and the way that Laurie Anderson both found something extraordinary in being able to access her loved one's voice, Lou Reed's voice, after he had died, but also in some cases and often the poetry that it generated, like she threw it away. Like it, and I think to me that says a lot about, or kind of resonates with my own experience of playing around with ChatGPT and thinking about what it means that we now can't deny, you know, the extent to which language is derivative in not in a bad sense, you know, that it is sort of a product of, you know, avalanches of information that are analyzed and then from that generate speech that is both new and a replica of some kind of what has been said before, or a prediction, I guess, is sort of more technically how it works.
And in my read of your work, I have to say, I thought he would be kind of a champion of AI, you know?
Yeah.
So it's really curious because there's so much negativity and fear around mm-hmm. it. But the way that you write about this is like, it's very normal. It's just part of our experience. And rather than resisting it, embrace it.
You know, I don't know. I'm not ready to say one way or another, but I love to hear what you think about it. But here's one thought that I did have, which is, so there's one of the concepts from Bakhtin that I really love is his idea of a loophole. And I write about it in the book, and he talks about a loophole is a word with a sidewards glance, is how he described it. It's those words that do kind of operate in more than one way at once. So an example would be when, you know, using scare quotes, that's a loophole, right? Where I'm sort of saying the thing, but I'm also disavowing the thing. Or when you put like a string of emojis after you've said something, you're like adding, it's a loophole. You can, that suddenly there's a little bit of give in sort of your relationship to your words and what they mean and what others can sort of say to you about what they mean. And I think what might be missing in the way we relate to chat, or the risk, I guess, of generative AI is if we don't have loopholes. Like, there need to be loopholes that allow for humanity always to kind of crack through and never be totally taken over by the machine. And that I'm sort of thinking about, and maybe I should talk to some AI developers about what is the equivalent of a loophole, or what is the equivalent of Bakhtin's idea of like multiple languages operating at once, so that there is that dynamic among different ways of speaking, as opposed to one sort of totalized voice generated by, a model.
Melissa, I think this is so interesting because I'm getting older, and I am thinking more about the loss of people. Mm-hmm. And I also, my dad relatively recently died. And so I think it's really interesting the way that you've managed to articulate something that a lot of us experience, but don't always have the language to articulate. And I think our culture, isn't really wired to recognize grieving and all the nuances and subtleties and depths and how it is an experience of time travel, really.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how we change and how our words outlive us. And you've made this into, you know, a source of consolation. So I wonder if you could speak to your experience of allowing these friends' words to be with you and how they stay with you and find loopholes and create a path through loss and grief.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I there's lots of sort of specific examples for myself. I mean, one example that I think about is a time when, so Christine performed my wedding ceremony and said some really, the kinds of things that you don't often hear at a wedding ceremony. She talked about there will be times of wounding and the necessity for healing, and it's good to be humble about the failings in others and in ourselves. And, you know, and at the time that she was saying them, I was like, what are you talking about? This is my wedding day, you know? And then, you know, years and decades go by and difficulties come. And there was one especially hard time that Chaz and I were going through, and I sat down to write an anniversary card for him, and I didn't know what to say. And so I used Christine's words, you know, and that was a way that she was already gone, but she appeared for me in where I suddenly heard what she was saying in an entirely different way than I did when I was 28 years old, or however old I was when I got married, I can't remember. And that sort of, and that was that kind of this moment of like a wrinkle in time, like she sort of zipped forward and was, I felt very present with her when I needed her. You know, so that's one example for myself. Another part of the book and the writing process is really about hearing and listening to, and also respecting the boundaries around Emily and Mercy's experiences of grief. So Emily was Johnny's wife, and they had two small children when he died. And Mercy was Christine's partner of 17 years. And so I just feel incredibly, speaking of being humble. I feel incredibly grateful and mindful of the trust that Mercy and Emily put in me, and other people who loved and were part of Emily, Christine and Johnny's families, to tell this story. So I think part of what I do in the book is like witness, is try to like very thoughtfully, that's my hope at least, witness not only, you know, the grief of others and to allow that to be a really big part of the story.
Thank you, Lissa. Congratulations.
Thank you, Lissa. This was wonderful.
Thank you.
We'll be right back with today's book trend after this short break.
Well, Grant, a story in February's Economist caught my eye that seemed kind of made for this episode when we're thinking about the topic of other people's words, titled Authors Are Collaborating with AI and Each Other. It's about the collaborative novel 14 Days, which is written by a whole bunch of literary notables, including Margaret Atwood, Douglas Preston, Emma Donoghue, Dave Eggers, and John Grisham, quite a lineup. And the premise of the book is just a bunch of tenants in the same apartment building escaping to their roof every night for 14 days during the early days of COVID to talk about life. Basically, it's just kind of friends talking and you get to listen in with some different authors in the mix. But, you know, it's cool because it's a collaborative novel, but hardly the first ever. And I think, you know, we're seeing more collaborative novels, probably to do with COVID and the ease of this kind of collaboration and just how we all went so online in 2020. And it was getting me thinking that that was the essence of our conversation with Helen McDonald and Sin Blanchet, who collaborated during COVID on their novel Profit. So I just wanted to, you know, hear your thoughts on the collaborative novel and a little bit about its history.
Yeah, I think it is a rising form. I definitely saw that at NaNoWriMo and experienced that, and I thought it was so interesting. And, you know, because there is a long tradition of scriptwriters collaborating on a script, but not many with novels. And I loved reading about this, and especially loved that 14 Days has a foreword by the lead editors, Atwood and Preston, and how they cite the influence of the Decameron, which is a 1353 collection of stories by Giovanni Boccaccio. And it's a collection of stories about a group of people who shelter in a villa near Florence to escape the bubonic plague. So there's this historical parallel and inspiration for their story dating back, you know, 700 years. So people should definitely read the Economist piece for a pretty detailed look at the many collaborative novels that exist and then many to come as well. And I think one of the interesting things about the novels to come is that the article references how ChatGPT, no surprise, is becoming a co-author. And generative AI services are, the article says, becoming, you know, collective works themselves, since they were trained on authors' books and writers' articles and posts from the internet. And ChatGPT is, as the Economist article calls it, a conversational machine, which can and is leading to collaborative writing, different kind of collaborative writing.
Yeah, the other term that jumped out at me from the article was cyborg authorship.
Good one.
I don't love it, but you know, if it sticks, I guess it's good because it's so arresting that maybe we'll stop to acknowledge that the co-author is a machine bot. So that would be kind of a good thing. The guy who coined this term, his name is Scott Rettberg from the University of Bergen in Norway. And he's actually co-curated an exhibit, Grant, here in Berkeley at Cal. And it's all about books written with the help of AI. It's called More Than Meets AI. And I hadn't even heard of this before, but we got to go and check that out since it's here in our hometown.
Yeah, we can report it live. Yeah.
We'll report back.
That term makes me realize that cyborg authorship, you know, it's more of a thing than I think we've realized. And ChatGPT is, you know, really only been out and available to the public a relatively short time since November 2022, but already, obviously, so much has already been done in this space. And, you know, I'm not going to begin to imagine the future, but I know, you know, the number of books we're going to see are going to be co-written or just written by cyborgs, maybe. And, you know, it's interesting to me because I'm feeling, I guess, the thaw and the frozen resistance towards ChatGPT and AI, because I was just talking to a very smart and very well-published author who was actually encouraging me to sign up for the professional version of ChatGPT just for this reason, to kind of have a built-in writing collaborator.
Oh my gosh, it's wild. Yeah. And the article that we're referencing, The Economist, you know, the authors of that piece assert that individual authors will still dominate creatively. We want to think that's right. You know, we want to believe that's true. They make the point that 14 days is cleverly woven together, but the book doesn't quite gel. And then finally, the article ends with a prediction of sorts, which is that authors are not going to want to cop to having used AI in their writing, especially not as a co-writer. But the article then mentions an author named Kudan Rhee, winner of Japan's top prize for literature, who admitted to having used ChatGPT to write 5% of her science fiction novel, which is called Tokyo Sympathy Tower. I have to say, Grant, I felt skeptical reading that. Like, if she's admitting to 5%, it's probably more like 20%. But still, the fact that she copped to it is refreshing, but also rare for now.
I think you're definitely right with that math, the 20% figure. But also, you know, I mean, it's interesting because that's an indicator that how attitudes change so quickly. And, you know, if you think about COVID, at first there was this stigma, but then once everyone was getting it, that stigma went away or it lessened. And this is the way stigmas function. You know, they lessen the more air and light they're given. And I think if the author of Tokyo Sympathy Tower is an award-winning author who used ChatGPT for a book, then that's just the beginning, you know? But that said, I doubt we're going to see ChatGPT or cyborg author getting co-credit on any book in our lifetimes. But then, I don't know. Who knows? I feel reluctant to predict anything when it comes to AI with the speed at which things are moving, except that it will become a writing collaborator of some sort for many of us. And we also want to be your writing collaborators here at Right Minded as well. So thank you so much for listening. And please remember to invite your human friends and collaborators to listen so that our collaborations are part of real life. We'll be back next week with another episode of Right Minded.